Dave Mitchum knew nothing about the philosophy of law, but he knew that when a court is not bound by any rules, it is not bound by any facts. And then a hearing is not an issue of justice, but an issue of men. And your fate depends not on what you have or have not done, but on whom you do or do not know. He asked himself what chance he would have at such a hearing against Mr. James Taggart, Mr. Clifton Losey, Mr. Kip Chalmers, and their powerful friends. Dave Mitchum had spent his life slipping around the necessity of ever making a decision. He had done it by waiting to be told, and never being certain of anything. All that he now allowed into his brain was a long, indignant whine against injustice. Fate, he thought, had singled him out for an unfair amount of bad luck. He was being framed by his superiors on the only good job he had ever held. He had never been taught to understand that the manner in which he obtained this job, and the frame-up, were inextricable parts of a single whole. As he looked at Losey's order, he thought that he could hold the Comet, attach Mr. Chalmers' car to an engine, and send it into the tunnel alone. But he shook his head before the thought was fully formed. He knew that this would force Mr. Chalmers to recognize the nature of the risk. Mr. Chalmers would refuse. He would continue to demand a safe and non-existent engine. And more, this would mean that he, Mitchum, would have to assume responsibility, admit full knowledge of the danger, stand in the open, and identify the exact nature of the situation. The one act which the policy of his superiors was based on evading, the one key to their game. Dave Mitchum was not the man to rebel against his background or to question the moral code of those in charge. The choice he made was not to challenge, but to follow the policy of his superiors. Bill Brent could have beaten him in any contest of technology, but here was an endeavor at which he could beat Bill Brent without effort. There had once been a society where men needed the particular talents of Bill Brent if they wished to survive. What they needed now was the talent of Dave Mitchum. Dave Mitchum sat down at his secretary's typewriter, and by means of two fingers, carefully typed out an order to the trainmaster and another to the road foreman. The first instructed the trainmaster to summon a locomotive crew at once for a purpose described only as an emergency. The second instructed the road foreman to send the best engine available to Winston to stand by for emergency assistance. He put carbon copies of the orders into his own pocket, then opened the door, yelled for the night dispatcher to come up, and handed him the two orders for the two men downstairs. The night dispatcher was a conscientious young boy who trusted his superiors and knew that discipline was the first rule of the railroad business. He was astonished that Mitchum should wish to send written orders down one flight of stairs, but he asked no questions. Mitchum waited nervously. After a while, he saw the figure of the road foreman walking across the yards toward the roundhouse. He felt relieved. The two men had not come up to confront him in person. They had understood, and they would play the game as he was playing it. The road foreman walked across the yards, looking down at the ground. He was thinking of his wife, his two children, and the house which he had spent a lifetime to own. He knew what his superiors were doing, and he wondered whether he should refuse to obey them. He had never been afraid of losing his job. With the confidence of a competent man, he had known that if he quarreled with one employer, he would always be able to find another. Now he was afraid. He had no right to quit or to seek a job. If he defied an employer, he would be delivered into the unanswerable power of a single board, and if the board ruled against him, it would mean being sentenced to the slow death of starvation. It would mean being barred from any employment. He knew that the board would rule against him. He knew that the key to the dark, capricious mystery of the board's contradictory decisions was the secret power of pull. What chance would he have against Mr. Chalmers? There had been a time when the self-interest of his employers had demanded that he exercise his utmost ability. Now ability was not wanted any longer. There had been a time when he had been required to do his best and rewarded accordingly. Now he could expect nothing but punishment if he tried to follow his conscience. There had been a time when he had been expected to think. Now they did not want him to think, only to obey. They did not want him to have a conscience any longer. Then why should he raise his voice? For whose sake? He thought of the passengers, the 300 passengers aboard the Comet. he thought of his children. He had a son in high school and a daughter, 19, of whom he was fiercely, painfully proud, because she was recognized as the most beautiful girl in town. He asked himself whether he could deliver his children to the fate of the children of the unemployed, as he had seen them in the blighted areas, in the settlements around closed factories, and along the tracks of discontinued railroads. He saw in astonished horror that the choice which he now had to make was between the lives of his children and the lives of the passengers on the Comet. A conflict of this kind had never been possible before. It was by protecting the safety of the passengers that he had earned the security of his children. He had served one by serving the other. There had been no clash of interests, no call for victims. Now, if he wanted to save the passengers, he had to do it at the price of his children. He remembered dimly the sermons he had heard about the beauty of self-immolation, about the virtue of sacrificing to others that which was one's dearest. He knew nothing about the philosophy of ethics, but he knew suddenly, not in words, but in the form of a dark, angry, savage pain, that if this was virtue, then he wanted no part of it. He walked into the roundhouse and ordered a large, ancient, coal-burning locomotive to be made ready for the run to Winston. The trainmaster reached for the telephone in the dispatcher's office to summon an engine crew, as ordered, but his hand stopped, holding the receiver. It struck him suddenly that he was summoning men to their death, and that of the 20 lives listed on the sheet before him, 2 would be ended by his choice. He felt a physical sensation of cold, nothing more. He felt no concern, only a puzzled, indifferent astonishment. It had never been his job to call men out to die. His job had been to call them out to earn their living. It was strange, he thought, and it was strange that his hand had stopped. What made it stop was like something he would have felt 20 years ago. No, he thought. Strange. Only 1 month ago, not longer. He was 48 years old. He had no family, no friends, no ties to any living being in the world. Whatever capacity for devotion he had possessed, the capacity which others scatter among many random concerns, he had given it whole to the person of his young brother, the brother, his junior by 25 years, whom he had brought up. He had sent him through a technological college, and he had known, as had all the teachers, that the boy had the mark of genius on the forehead of his grim young face. With the same single-track devotion as his brother's, the boy had cared for nothing but his studies, not for sports or parties or girls, only for the vision of the things he was going to create as an inventor. He had graduated from college and had gone on a salary unusual for his age into the research laboratory of a great electrical concern in Massachusetts. This was now May 28th, thought the trainmaster. It was on May 1st that Directive 10-289 had been issued. It was on the evening of May 1st that he had been informed that his brother had committed suicide. The trainmaster had heard it said that the directive was necessary to save the country. He could not know whether this was true or not. He had no way of knowing what was necessary to save a country. But driven by some feeling which he could not express, he had walked into the office of the editor of the local newspaper and demanded that they publish the story of his brother's death. "People have to know it," had been all he could give as his reason. He had been unable to explain that the bruised connections of his mind had formed the wordless conclusion that if this was done by the will of the people, then the people had to know it. He could not believe that they would do it if they knew. The editor had refused. He had stated that it would be bad for the country's morale. The trainmaster knew nothing about political philosophy, but he knew that that had been the moment when he lost all concern for the life or death of any human being, or of the country. He thought, holding the telephone receiver, that maybe he should warn the men whom he was about to call. They trusted him. It would never occur to them that he could knowingly send them to their death. But he shook his head. This was only an old thought, last year's thought, a remnant of the time when he had trusted them too. It did not matter now. His brain worked slowly, as if he were dragging his thoughts through a vacuum where no emotion responded to spur them on. He thought that there would be trouble if he warned anyone. There would be some sort of fight, and it was he who had to make some great effort to start it. He had forgotten what it was that one started this sort of fight for. Truth?
Justice? Brother love? He did not want to make an effort. He was very tired. If he warned all the men on his list, he thought, there would be no one to run that engine. So he would save 2 lives, and also 300 lives aboard the Comet. But nothing responded to the figures in his mind. Lives was just a word. It had no meaning. He raised the telephone receiver to his ear. He called 2 numbers. He summoned an engineer and a fireman to report for duty at once. Engine number 306 had left for Winston when Dave Mitchum came downstairs. "Get a track motor car ready for me," he ordered. "I'm going to run up to Fairmount." Fairmount was a small station, 20 miles east on the line. The men nodded, asking no questions. Bill Brent was not among them. Mitchum walked into Brent's office. Brent was there, sitting silently at his desk. He seemed to be waiting. "I'm going to Fairmount," said Mitchum. His voice was aggressively too casual, as if implying that no answer was necessary. "They had a diesel there a couple of weeks ago. You know, emergency repairs or something. I'm going down to see if we could use it." He paused, but Brent said nothing. "The way things stack up," said Mitchum, not looking at him, "we can't hold that train till morning. We've got to take a chance, one way or another. Now, I think maybe this diesel will do it, but that's the last one we can try for. So if you don't hear from me in half an hour, sign the order and send the Comet through with number 306 to pull her." Whatever Brent had thought, he could not believe it when he heard it. He did not answer at once. Then he said very quietly, "No." "What do you mean, no?"
"I won't do it."
"What do you mean you won't? It's an order."
"I won't do it."
Brent's voice had the firmness of certainty, unclouded by any emotion. "Are you refusing to obey an order?"
"I am."
"But you have no right to refuse. And I'm not going to argue about it either. It's what I've decided. It's my responsibility, and I'm not asking for your opinion. Your job is to take my orders."
"Will you give me that order in writing?"
"Why, God damn you, are you hinting that you don't trust me? Are you—"
"Why do you have to go to Fairmount, Dave? Why can't you telephone them about that diesel if you think that they have one?"
"You are not going to tell me how to do my job. You're not going to sit there and question me. You're going to keep your trap shut and do as you're told, or I'll give you a chance to talk to the Unification Board."
It was hard to decipher emotions on Brent's cowboy face. But Mitchum saw something that resembled a look of incredulous horror. Only it was horror at some sight of his own, not at the words. And it had no quality of fear, not the kind of fear Mitchum had hoped for. Brent knew that tomorrow morning the issue would be his word against Mitchum's. Mitchum would deny having given the order. Mitchum would show written proof that engine number 306 had been sent to Winston only to stand by, and would produce witnesses that he had gone to Fairmount in search of a diesel. Mitchum would claim that the fatal order had been issued by and on the sole responsibility of Bill Brent, the chief dispatcher. It would not be much of a case, not a case that could bear close study, but it would be enough for the Unification Board, whose policy was consistent only in not permitting anything to be studied closely. Brent knew that he could play the same game and pass the frame up onto another victim. He knew that he had the brains to work it out, except that he would rather be dead than do it. It was not the sight of Mitchum that made him sit still in horror. It was the realization that there was no one whom he could call to expose this thing and stop it. No superior anywhere on the line, from Colorado to Omaha to New York. They were in on it, all of them. They were doing the same. They had given Mitchum the lead and the method. It was Dave Mitchum who now belonged on this railroad, and he, Bill Brent, who did not. As Bill Brent had learned to see by a single glance at a few numbers on a sheet of paper, the entire trackage of a division. So he was now able to see the whole of his own life, and the full price of the decision he was making. He had not fallen in love until he was past his youth. He had been 36 when he had found the woman he wanted. He had been engaged to her for the last 4 years. He had had to wait because he had a mother to support, and a widowed sister with 3 children. He had never been afraid of burdens because he had known his ability to carry them, and he had never assumed an obligation unless he was certain that he could fulfill it. He had waited. He had saved his money. And now he had reached the time when he felt himself free to be happy. He was to be married in a few weeks, this coming June. He
He thought of it as he sat at his desk, looking at Dave Mitchum. But the thought aroused no hesitation, only regret and a distant sadness. Distance because he knew that he could not let it be part of this moment. Bill Brent knew nothing about epistemology, but he knew that man must live by his own rational perception of reality, that he cannot act against it or escape it or find a substitute for it, and that there is no other way for him to live. He rose to his feet.
"It's true that so long as I hold this job, I cannot refuse to obey you," he said. "But I can, if I quit. So I'm quitting."
"You're what?"
"I'm quitting, as of this moment."
"But you have no right to quit, you goddamn bastard. Don't you know that? Don't you know that I'll have you thrown in jail for it?"
"If you want to send the sheriff for me in the morning, I'll be at home. I won't try to escape. There's no place to go."
Dave Mitchum was 6'2" and had the build of a bruiser. But he stood shaking with fury and terror over the delicate figure of Bill Brent. "You can't quit. There's a law against it. I've got a law. You can't walk out on me. I won't let you out. I won't let you leave this building tonight."
Brent walked to the door. "Will you repeat that order you gave me in front of the others?" "No? Then I will."
As he pulled the door open, Mitchum's fist shot out, smashed into his face, and knocked him down. The train master and the road foreman stood in the open doorway. "He quit," screamed Mitchum. "The yellow bastard quit at a time like this. He's a lawbreaker and a coward." In the slow effort of rising from the floor, through the haze of blood running into his eyes, Bill Brent looked up at the two men. He saw that they understood, but he saw the closed faces of men who did not want to understand, did not want to interfere, and hated him for putting them on the spot in the name of justice. He said nothing, rose to his feet, and walked out of the building. Mitchum avoided looking at the others. "Hey, you," he called, jerking his head at the night dispatcher across the room. "Come here. You've got to take over at once." With the door closed, he repeated to the boy the story of the diesel at Fairmount, as he had given it to Brent, and the order to send the Comet through with engine number 306, if the boy did not hear from him in half an hour. The boy was in no condition to think, to speak, or to understand anything. He kept seeing the blood on the face of Bill Brent, who had been his idol. "Yes, sir," he answered numbly. Dave Mitchum departed for Fairmount, announcing to every yardman, switchman, and wiper in sight as he boarded the track motor car that he was going in search of a diesel for the Comet. The night dispatcher sat at his desk, watching the clock and the telephone, praying that the telephone would ring and let him hear from Mr. Mitchum. But the half hour went by in silence, and when there were only 3 minutes left, the boy felt a terror he could not explain, except that he did not want to send that order. He turned to the train master and the road foreman, asking hesitantly, "Mr. Mitchum gave me an order before he left, but I wonder whether I ought to send it, because I don't think it's right." He said. The train master turned away. He felt no pity. The boy was about the same age as his brother had been. The road foreman snapped, "Do just as Mr. Mitchum told you. You're not supposed to think," and walked out of the room. The responsibility that James Taggart and Clifton Losey had evaded now rested on the shoulders of a trembling, bewildered boy. He hesitated. Then he buttressed his courage with the thought that one did not doubt the good faith and the competence of railroad executives. He did not know that his vision of a railroad and its executives was that of a century ago. With the conscientious precision of a railroad man, in the moment when the hand of the clock ended the half hour, he signed his name to the order instructing the Comet to proceed with engine number 306, and transmitted the order to Winston Station. The station agent at Winston shuddered when he looked at the order, but he was not the man to defy authority. He told himself that the tunnel was not perhaps as dangerous as he thought. He told himself that the best policy these days was not to think. When he handed their copies of the order to the conductor and the engineer of the Comet, the conductor glanced slowly about the room from face to face, folded the slip of paper, put it into his pocket, and walked out without a word. The engineer stood looking at the paper for a moment.
then threw it down and said, "I'm not going to do it. And if it's come to where this railroad hands out orders like this one, I'm not going to work for it either. Just list me as having quit."
"But you can't quit," cried the station agent. "They'll arrest you for it."
"If they find me," said the engineer, and walked out of the station into the vast darkness of the mountain night. The engineer from Silver Springs, who had brought in number 306, was sitting in a corner of the room. He chuckled and said, "He's yellow." The station agent turned to him. "Will you do it, Joe? Will you take the Comet?" Joe Scott was drunk. There had been a time when a railroad man reporting for duty with any sign of intoxication would have been regarded as a doctor arriving for work with sores of smallpox on his face. But Joe Scott was a privileged person. 3 months ago he had been fired for an infraction of safety rules, which had caused a major wreck. 2 weeks ago he had been reinstated in his job by order of the Unification Board. He was a friend of Fred Kinnon. He protected Kinnon's interests in his union, not against the employers, but against the membership. "Sure," said Joe Scott. "I'll take the Comet. I'll get her through if I go fast enough." The fireman of number 306 had remained in the cab of his engine. He looked up uneasily when they came to switch his engine to the head end of the Comet. He looked up at the red and green lights of the tunnel, hanging in the distance above 20 miles of curves. But he was a placid, amiable fellow, who made a good fireman, with no hope of ever rising to engineer. His husky muscles were his only asset. He felt certain that his superiors knew what they were doing, so he did not venture any questions. The conductor stood by the rear end of the Comet. He looked at the lights of the tunnel, then at the long chain of the Comet's windows. A few windows were lighted, but most of them showed only the feeble blue glow of night lamps edging the lowered blinds. He thought that he should rouse the passengers and warn them. There had been a time when he had placed the safety of the passengers above his own, not by reason of love for his fellow men, but because that responsibility was part of his job, which he accepted, and felt pride in fulfilling. Now he felt a contemptuous indifference, and no desire to save them. They had asked for and accepted Directive 10-289, he thought. They went on living, and daily turning away in evasion from the kind of verdicts that the Unification Board was passing on defenseless victims. Why shouldn't he now turn away from them? If he saved their lives, not one of them would come forward to defend him when the Unification Board would convict him for disobeying orders, for creating a panic, for delaying Mr. Chalmers. He had no desire to be a martyr for the sake of allowing people safely to indulge in their own irresponsible evil. When the moment came, he raised his lantern and signaled the engineer to start. "See," said Kip Chalmers triumphantly to Lester Tuck, as the wheels under their feet shuddered forward. "Fear is the only practical means to deal with people." The conductor stepped onto the vestibule of the last car. No one saw him as he went down the steps of the other side, slipped off the train, and vanished into the darkness of the mountains. A switchman stood ready to throw the switch that would send the Comet from the siding onto the main track. He looked at the Comet as it came slowly toward him. It was only a blazing white globe with a beam stretching high above his head, and a jerky thunder trembling through the rail under his feet. He knew that the switch should not be thrown. He thought of the night 10 years ago, when he had risked his life in a flood to save a train from a washout. But he knew the times had changed. In the moment when he threw the switch and saw the headlight jerk sidewise, he knew that he would now hate his job for the rest of his life. The Comet uncoiled from the siding into a thin, straight line, and went on into the mountains with the beam of the headlight like an extended arm pointing the way, and the lighted glass curve of the observation lounge ending it off. Some of the passengers aboard the Comet were awake. As the train started its coiling ascent, they saw the small cluster of Winston's lights at the bottom of the darkness beyond their windows. Then the same darkness, but with red and green lights by the hole of a tunnel on the upper edge of the window panes. The lights of Winston kept growing smaller each time they appeared. The black hole of the tunnel kept growing larger. A black veil went streaking past the windows at times, dimming the lights. It was the heavy smoke from the coal-burning engine. As the tunnel came closer, they saw at the edge of the sky, far to the south, in a void of space and rock, a spot of living fire twisting in the wind.
they did not know what it was, and did not care to learn. It is said that catastrophes are a matter of pure chance, and there were those who would have said that the passengers of the comet were not guilty or responsible for the thing that happened to them. The man in bedroom A, car number 1, was a professor of sociology, who taught that individual ability is of no consequence, that individual effort is futile, that an individual conscience is a useless luxury, that there is no individual mind or character or achievement, that everything is achieved collectively, and that it's masses that count, not men. The man in roomette 7, car number 2, was a journalist, who wrote that it is proper and moral to use compulsion for a good cause, who believed that he had the right to unleash physical force upon others, to wreck lives, throttle ambitions, strangle desires, violate convictions, to imprison, to despoil, to murder, for the sake of whatever he chose to consider as his own idea of a good cause, which did not even have to be an idea, since he had never defined what he regarded as the good, but had merely stated that he went by a feeling unrestrained by any knowledge, since he considered emotion superior to knowledge, and relied solely on his own good intentions and on the power of a gun. The woman in roomette 10, car number 3, was an elderly school teacher who had spent her life turning class after class of helpless children into miserable cowards, by teaching them that the will of the majority is the only standard of good and evil, that a majority may do anything it pleases, that they must not assert their own personalities, but must do as others were doing. The man in drawing room B, car number 4, was a newspaper publisher who believed that men are evil by nature and unfit for freedom, that their basic interests, if left unchecked, are to lie, to rob, and to murder one another, and therefore men must be ruled by means of lies, robbery, and murder, which must be made the exclusive privilege of the rulers, for the purpose of forcing men to work, teaching them to be moral, and keeping them within the bounds of order and justice. The man in bedroom H, car number 5, was a businessman who had acquired his business, an ore mine, with the help of a government loan under the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. The man in drawing room A, car number 6, was a financier who had made a fortune by buying frozen railroad bonds and getting his friends in Washington to defreeze them. The man in seat 5, car number 7, was a worker who believed that he had a right to a job whether his employer wanted him or not. The woman in roomette 6, car number 8, was a lecturer who believed that as a consumer she had a right to transportation, whether the railroad people wished to provide it or not. The man in roomette 2, car number 9, was a professor of economics who advocated the abolition of private property, explaining that intelligence plays no part in industrial production, that man's mind is conditioned by material tools, that anybody can run a factory or a railroad, and it's only a matter of seizing the machinery. The woman in bedroom D, car number 10, was a mother who had put her 2 children to sleep in the berth above her, carefully tucking them in, protecting them from drafts and jolts, a mother whose husband held a government job enforcing directives, which she defended by saying, "I don't care. It's only the rich that they hurt. After all, I must think of my children." The man in room at 3, car number 11, was a sniveling little neurotic who wrote cheap little plays, into which, as a social message, he inserted cowardly little obscenities, to the effect that all businessmen were scoundrels. The woman in room at 9, car number 12, was a housewife who believed that she had the right to elect politicians, of whom she knew nothing, to control giant industries, of which she had no knowledge. The man in bedroom F, car number 13, was a lawyer who had said, "Me? I'll find a way to get along under any political system." The man in bedroom A, car number 14, was a professor of philosophy who taught that there is no mind.
"How do you know that the tunnel is dangerous?"
"No reality."
"How can you prove that the tunnel exists?"
"No logic."
"Why do you claim that trains cannot move without motive power?"
"No principles."
"Why should you be bound by the law of cause and effect?"
"No rights."
"Why shouldn't you attach men to their jobs by force?"
"No morality."
"What's moral about running a railroad?"
"No absolutes."
"What difference does it make to you whether you live or die anyway?"
He taught that we know nothing.
"Why oppose the orders of your superiors?"
"That we can never be certain of anything."
"How do you know you're right?"
"That we must act on the expediency of the moment."
"You don't want to risk your job, do you?"